The Western mind is stuck in the past. They cannot see that the world has changed. The world order that the West built after the Second World War is actually shifting, and shifting very fast. But it is not noticed or seen properly by decision makers. We are on a brink of a major dangerous moment. And the Americans cannot see it. Maybe they can, but it seems that they are sleepwalking into it.
Welcome to The Big Picture, a show about the past, the present, and the future. My name is Mohammed Hassan, and today I sit down with journalist, political strategist, and thinker Wadaa Khanfar. Khanfar is a former director general of Al Jazeera Media Network and presided over its expansion from an Arabic language channel to the international brand it's known for today. In 2011, as Al Jazeera led global coverage of the Arab Spring uprisings, Khanfar was named by Foreign Policy magazine among the top 100 global thinkers. He stepped down later that year, then went on to establish Al-Sharq Forum, a non-profit organization whose stated aims are to promote democracy, pluralism, and justice throughout the Middle East and beyond. Khanfar is a Palestinian, born in a village near the city of Jenin in the West Bank, and he's been one of the most influential voices analyzing the Israel-Palestine conflict. In May of this year, he debated at the Cambridge Union the notion that Israel must be pressured into giving up its occupation.
No one in the world, no respected body or government or international law in the world does not recognize that the land of Palestine in 1967 was occupied, but Israel and the lawyers of Israel. This is the same terminology that this House adopted the resolution that the House will send the troops to defend Ukraine against the Russian occupation. The word occupation is important. Why was that removed from the motion, I wonder?
I spoke with Khanfar just 3 weeks on from the events of October 7th, when Hamas militants launched a surprise attack on southern Israel, breaking through a 17-year siege on the Gaza Strip and attacking military and civilian outposts. 1,400 Israelis were killed and more than 200 held captive. It was followed by a devastating and ongoing aerial bombardment of Gaza by Israel, killing so far 8,000 Palestinians, though the number rises dramatically each day. Israel has also cut off access to water, fuel, electricity, medical supplies, and periodically communication, as it vows to crush Hamas and resistance groups, though its end goal remains unclear. More than 100 Palestinians have also been killed in the West Bank as Israeli army and settler attacks escalate. International voices have called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, but that call has not been backed by Israel's primary ally, the United States, or the United Kingdom. 30 years on from the ill-fated Oslo Accords and that attempt to resolve the Palestinian question, and that resolution feels like a distant memory, unreachable amid the anger, the grief, and the escalating calls for revenge. The conflict and the region stand at an inflection point, and what happens next could spiral into something no one is prepared for. So, where does that leave the concept of peace? And where does that leave Palestine? Wadaa Khanfar, it's a pleasure to have you today. Welcome to The Big Picture.
Thank you very much.
There is a lot that I want to talk to you about, a lot that I want to pick your brain on as to what is happening today, but also the ramifications of what could happen over the next couple of months, maybe years. But I want to begin by asking you, from your perspective, where was the Palestinian question, the Palestinian plight, the day before October 7th?
The day before October 7th, the Israelis thought that they have achieved they have achieved whatever they couldn't achieve before. Netanyahu government declared, basically, that there is nothing called Palestinian land or a future for Palestine in any part of the historical Palestine. So basically, if you remember just a few days before 7 of October in New York, when he just carried the map where there is no land for the Palestinians, and of course he was talking in his program for the government in December 2022, that this is the time to consolidate our control of all the land of Israel, And he basically spoke about what does that word mean, the land of Israel. And he included all the land that Israel is occupying now, Golan Heights, and also the West Bank. So basically, what has been said about peace process or about Oslo or something like that ended. You should remember that this year we should have been celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Palestinian state based on Oslo Accord. But what we got, a government in Israel that denied anything related to Palestinians while busy normalizing relationship with Arab regimes and getting the infinite support of the Americans and the Western leaders. So therefore, the Israelis basically are trying to forget about something called Palestinians and trying to build their existence as an apartheid state, while the Palestinians are controlled in West Bank by the Palestinian National Authority, which is serving the Israeli security, and in Gaza, a concentration camp under starvation blockade. And okay, that's it. And this is, we can move on and forget about anything called Palestine or Palestinians. So that was the moment that led to 7th of October. So 7th of October is not a surprise. If you are monitoring the situation on the ground and not forgetting, like most of the international media, about something called Palestine or Palestinians, you would have noticed that settlers in West Bank are now engaged on daily attacks against the Palestinians. And you will find that the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem has been technically divided. You know, this is the first time since 1967 that it's happening. And you will find that Gaza blockade has been declared at a status quo and there is no hope for any kind of solution. And normalization process in the region that excludes totally any mention of Palestinians, but in a very general terms, just for public and domestic consumption in the Arab world. So the scene was that much, and therefore 7th of October was, in my opinion, a result of that kind of build-up that happened before, especially during the last few months of Netanyahu government.
When we're looking at the events of October 7th and certainly the way the international community has reacted to it, the thing that immediately comes to mind are comparisons to the first and the second intifadas. This feels like the most significant event that has taken place since then. The one primary difference between what is happening today and what happened on the second intifada was that back in the early 2000s, there was a clear sense of who was speaking for the Palestinians, who was in a leadership position in for the Palestinian cause, both within the Palestinian territories, but also internationally. Today, that question is a lot murkier. It's a lot more uncertain. You have a Palestinian president who a lot of Palestinians feel don't represent them. You also have Hamas, who is attempting to become that Palestinian voice, but it's also an organization that is, you know, a terrorist organization in the UK and the US. Israel hasn't been negotiating with or speaking to, at least publicly or formally, for many, many years. What does that picture of leadership look like today for Palestinians?
So we had the opportunity of having that unified voice to represent the Palestinians when there was elections held in West Bank and Gaza that led to a unified national government. And of course, the West and the Israelis were not happy with the fact that Hamas won majority seats in the legislature at that time. And that what led to the current reality that we are in. So when it was left for the Palestinians accepted certain kind of arrangement, and they have a voice, they had a voice to represent them. And by then, we would have seen that this voice would have dealt with the political issues in a very reasonable and even pragmatic way. But the Western pressure Because, you know, when you said international community, that word now has lost a lot of merit. Because what we speak about as international community normally in our minds is the West, the Americans and the Western governments, not the rest of the world. But we have seen that the rest of the world, a huge amount of humans across the world, are not exactly following the same method that the Western powers or stance the Western powers have regarding Palestine, especially in the voting of the General Assembly and on many other issues. So it is basically the West, especially the Americans, versus the rest of the world, the Global South, which is now second fiddle of the way the Americans are trying to manage the world. International law that has been sacrificed for a long time now. The self-righteousness the Americans are attempting to show to the world while they are committing all kinds of atrocities against democracies. One of them, of course, the national government that was elected by the Palestinians, but all the democracies in the Middle East, basically, during the Arab Spring, I think the Americans and the Western powers were not happy with the transformation. And lately, of course, the Ukrainian war and what happened of ignoring international law and, of course, going beyond that to redesign the international order in a way that, in my opinion, is ignoring basics of decency. And this, of course, will not at all appease nations across the world, especially outside the centric, the Western-centric approach to reality. So the international society, when I speak about international society, in fact, I am not at this moment in time inclined at all to look at the West, in particular the Americans, as the custodians of this international society. The time has come for the Global South to start thinking beyond the West. And in my opinion, the decay of Western values that have reached to this moment, where you glorify apartheid Israel in destroying and killing people, including children, thousands of kids and children, without even giving these children the respect they deserve or their families by acknowledging them, acknowledging their death. The American president is not even acknowledging that there are civilian deaths in Gaza, and he's speaking about Hamas figures that have been exaggerated. You know, what kind of leadership, what kind of model the West is giving us now? I think it is the end. The end of that kind of model that has been for decades trying to establish itself as the reference point for a so-called civilized world. You know, what kind of civilization is this that killed children while denying them food, drinks, bombing hospitals, and killing their parents, and of course denying the knowledge or even the acknowledgement of their death? This is very low moment in the history of the Western values, and I think it is, in a way or another, a moment for the world to move on and to start thinking beyond the Western colonial, imperial, hegemonic nature.
And the parallel that you make with Ukraine is something that the U.S. President Joe Biden himself reiterated over the last couple of weeks. And there's been enormous backlash to the way that, publicly at least, the U.S. has handled this situation with regard to its what has been perceived as almost blanket support for Israel and its attack on Gaza, for its refusal to stray away from what is an official Israeli line on what is happening there. And you saw that fallout happen even within President Biden's own administration and his own Congress. When it comes to his view of the world, Joe Biden's view of the world, and what he has attempted to reinstate, or, you know, when he first came into power, he said that, you know, America is back. And last week he tweeted that the world is a safer place with American leadership. Do you think that sense of American leadership is even real anymore? And is anyone paying attention to it?
In fact, what is amazing about the current situation is that the American behavior in supporting the Israeli aggression against the Palestinians is against the American national interest, if you think about it. Because you are engaged now, technically, in a confrontation and in a war against the civilians in Gaza, and dragged back into the Middle East while you were trying to dedicate most of your resources to confront China and Russia. Now back into the Middle East. And you should remember that the Americans have been here long time ago. I mean, they haven't departed from the region, but of course they reduced their military presence in the region. They have been here in Afghanistan. They have fought a war in Iraq. And in both wars, they had to withdraw without achieving any strategic target, especially in Afghanistan and, of course, even in Iraq. So while they were busy fighting this kind of ghost war, the Chinese and the Russians were building themselves. So the strategic interest of the Americans at that moment in time was sacrificed for an interest which did not achieve to them security as they thought it will. And the Chinese now are much more powerful than ever. Now they are coming back to the Middle East, the Americans. And once you are in this region, and if this war goes longer and longer, it means you will dedicate more resources and you might get directly involved in confrontation with Iran or with Hezbollah, with any other kind of force in the region. And who is going to be happy? The Chinese. Who is going to be happy? The Russians, of course, because again, the Americans are engaged in another war and they are dedicated resources to that. So I cannot understand how an administration like that puts its, you know, direct domestic interest above the national interest. It seems that the decay of leadership in the West, by the way, not only in America, but also look at Britain. So it's not Biden, it's also Sunak, it's also Scholz, it's also, French Macron. This kind of leadership has lost that sense of a strategy, and it is short-sighted, and it is implicating the West in something bigger than what the West could handle while the West is preparing to confront China and to confront Russia. So, yes, I agree that what's happening in America is very bizarre, actually, very strange, you know. Of course, you could refer to John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt in their book about the Israel lobby and American U.S. foreign policy, which was written, actually, in 2007. And in that book, they detail how the Israel lobby in the United States affected the American foreign policy against the American strategic interest. In my opinion, what we see now is an extension of that deceptive approach to the American interest and American national interest. And again, Biden is following Netanyahu's basically misguided trip towards creating this kind of confrontation, which might go beyond all kind of expectations, especially if it goes regional, and it might even become a regional international proxy in the region. So, yeah, we are on a brink of a major dangerous moment, and the Americans cannot see it. Maybe they can, but it seems that they are sleepwalking into it. Plus, of course, the Western leaders in Europe, who I think have lost as well a lot of sense of a strategy, and they are following the Americans also blindly. And this is a very dangerous moment for the world.
And you're seeing the kind of language that has been used, not only, of course, by Israel, you know, comparisons between Hamas and ISIS and saying that this is a global attack on the Western world and on civilization and all this kind of language. But you've seen that language being copied and reinforced by Western leaders as well. Certainly here in the UK, with the way that the Home Secretary, for example, has been talking about the situation, Suella Braverman, but also in the US, this language of the attack on October 7th being a part of a global terror trend and an extension of the war on terror that the US has been leading on over the last 2.5 decades, which also seems, I mean, it seems very bizarre to be making that comparison. But why is it that these Western countries are so willing to engage in this kind of fight that has, you know, if you're generous over the last 2 decades, well, had failed to achieve what its targets were? And if you're not being generous, you would say that it has only made the region and the world more dangerous, and it has only increased the level of hostility towards these Western countries and the way that they're able to operate in their interests in the region. What is there to be gained from turning this into a global war against terrorism?
International powers, when they start losing their status as the world hegemons, they normally start losing balance as well. They think the Americans in particular are at this moment in time losing balance. They have lost it a long time ago, maybe 2001, after 11 September. We saw what happened when the Americans led this international coalition against Afghanistan into a futile war that led to nothing, basically, but, you know, engaged the Americans and the NATO in a 20 years war where they had to evacuate Afghanistan and to withdraw, hand over back to Taliban. And of course, the war on Iraq, which basically was based on totally falsified information regarding nuclear weapons. And they put Iraq into the current situation where there is a lot of complications, chaos, sectarian conflicts, and so on and so forth. Beside the fact that also they handed Iraq to Iran. So, I mean, that kind of lack of balance, I see it. I see it in these strategic circles in the West, especially in the United States of America. And I was in Afghanistan 2001. I was covering the war there. The Americans used the shock and awe methodology in both Afghanistan and in Iraq by using massive bombs. So what's happening in Gaza now happened actually in Afghanistan and Iraq before that. They destroyed, they killed, they did a lot of things, but eventually they couldn't do anything much more than that. They left behind a huge amount of hatred and anger and the frustration, not only in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also in the global South, in the Islamic world, in the Arab world. And this accumulation of anger and the frustration, we see now how it is playing out through the massive demonstrations everywhere, because people could see the injustice. And the rhetoric the American leaders and the Western leaders are putting forward to media is not convincing, but also actually frustrating. You know, it assumes the ignorance of audience. We have had all these kind of experiences before, and we knew the rhetoric that led to all these kind of wars, the denial of massacres that happened in Afghanistan and in Iraq. I remember that I was covering this kind of stories. The Iraqis were bombed and killed and maimed and destroyed, and the Americans do not even acknowledge the responsibility for killing them. Journalists were killed, and the Americans did not acknowledge the killing of them. So what the Israelis are doing is what the Americans actually did as well before. And therefore, you know, the world in large is witnessing this kind of hypocrisy and double standards. And I think people are growing very furious, and the Americans are losing it. And of course, a stupid guy one day will ask us, why you hit us? I mean, imagine sometimes there is very naive thinking, especially in the American circles, about the Arab world, the Islamic world, and the South, the global South altogether. I don't know. Does it spring from the fact that maybe the Western leaders think of the exceptionalism, the divine right that they should have against everyone else? I am now horrified to listen to them invoking religious statements, claiming that this is a crusade and this is a religious war, and quoting from certain kind of quotations about justifying genocide against men, women, and children, as Netanyahu did a few days ago when he was speaking about the Israeli army as a continuation of 3,000 years of legacy since Joshua bin Nun. And we know what happened when Joshua bin Nun, according to the Old Testament, cursed Jericho and destroyed it and killed everyone. So the point is, this kind of logic shows you that there is imbalance in the mindset of the decision makers when they resort to this form of anger, frustration, invoking religious wars, and so on and so forth. It means that they are losing their balance and they are behaving in a very dangerous way. And this is definitely one of the most dangerous moments in our history, because we have also leaders who are not qualified to manage this moment.
And on that note, actually, one of the alarming things that in the first couple of days that we saw in terms of international coverage, in terms of the reaction from world leaders, in terms of the reaction from analysts, specifically the ones in the US, was almost a mirror image of what it felt like in the days after the September 11 attacks in 2001. This conversation around religion, this conversation around a quote-unquote clash of civilization, and us versus them, that it seems alarming. Also, the level of Islamophobia in the way that a lot of events were being talked about, the equivocation of pro-Palestinian marches with pro-Islamist marches or jihadists. And this idea feels almost alarming because it almost felt like the last two decades worth of conversations and analysis and dialogue have been for nothing, but it almost feels like things have been flipped on their heads again, and we're back right back to where we started. Is this how it feels to you?
Sadly, media has played a very negative role, mainstream Western media in particular, during the last few weeks, in amplifying this kind of madness and hatred, and denying the Palestinians the acknowledgement of their plight. And they do what they do usually by just eliminating the context and the history of any event. So they start just as if the Middle East was going through a great moment of peace and prosperity, and suddenly the mad Palestinians decided to disturb this peace and balance by creating this event on 7th of October. So, unfortunately, the Swiss media, which in my opinion is serving centers of power, has reached a moment of denial of the just cause of the Palestinians. And they, in a way or another, again invoked certain kind of feelings. So a lot of, in every nation, and even humans, we have always certain kind of thoughts and ideas. We bury them deep down. Sometimes they are very negative. We are ashamed of them. But in moments like that, all that surface on top. So we become xenophobic, racist, and we start assume that we are superior and we are self-righteous, and we should definitely eliminate, kill, and destroy the enemy totally, because they're not humans, they're animals, like this kind of rhetoric that the Israelis and some American American politicians are repeating. So we have that kind of mentality. Now, going back to the reality, does this kind of logic appease everyone? In my opinion, the Western nations are not happy to see their leaders behaving the way that they are behaving. We saw the demonstrations in London. We saw the Paris demonstrations, we saw it in Germany, everywhere. Although the laws and regulations that the governments of these countries try to enforce were actually, in my opinion, not only anti-democratic, but it were barbaric in a way, you know, by trying to suppress people from showing their sympathy to dead men and women and children in Gaza. But regardless, the people demonstrated. And this is a very good sign. It means our debate and discussion that you refer to is not gone, unnoticed. Actually, yes, there is a lot of people now who see the reality and the truth, regardless of media and regardless of the political stance. So it is not as if we have lost totally the West. We have lost the centers of power in the West that has been, in a way or another, serving the Israeli interest blindly, as I said, against their national interest even. But the people, I think, will start to see the reality, and they are seeing the reality more and more. And this is very good news. So take, for example, the slogan that the whole war started. Israel has the right to defend itself. Someone would ask the Palestinians, do they have the right to exist? Do they have the right to defend themselves? If you say no, they are not, it means we are not acknowledging the Palestinians as the humans equal to the Israelis, for example, and therefore they don't have the right. Now you are defending, when you say Israel has the right to defend itself, you are looking at Israel as oppressed small minority surrounded by brutal Palestinians with their mighty army and their bombs and their massive artillery, and Israel has the right to defend itself. Israel is an apartheid state trying to defend itself against the occupied people, you know, who have been put in a concentration camp for the last 16 years under starvation. And then you tell me we have the right to, Israel has the right to defend itself. Of course, this logic is easily, you can say, how ridiculous it is. And any sane mind will look at facts. He will understand that this is not what a sound argument for the Israelis to do what they are doing. And therefore, I think more and more people in the West, of course, the global South, most of it, basically have gone through this before us. They have gone through this in Africa, you know, during colonial era. We cannot eliminate the fact that what we see now is an extension of that mentality that colonized Africa, that enslaved Africa, that killed 10 billion people in Congo by the Belgian king at that time, by the apartheid state of South Africa that the West supported and declared Nelson Mandela at that time as a terrorist before he was celebrated as a liberator and got a Nobel Peace Prize. So the West has been there. That dark history has been there. And unfortunately, because of this particular moment, all this dark actions and memories and subconscious is coming to the front and expressing itself in a very ugly way in media and in political terms. And this is why this moment is actually a moment of truth. When you are unmasking someone and, you know, putting him in front of the mirror and the world naked from all kind of claims about the self-righteousness and about the liberal values and about supporting democracy and about the civilized world versus the non-civilized and about the axis of civility versus the axis of evil. All that, I think, now has been destroyed and this image is shattered when we are watching the current unfolding events.
Is there a threshold for you, and do you think there should be one for the United States government, at which the U.S. would say, let's hold off for a second in terms of civilian casualties? Is there a point at which you would start to question?
No, if somebody asked us after World War II, is there a limit what you would do to make sure that Japan and Germany don't conquer the world? Is there any limit what Israel should do to the people who are trying to slaughter the Jews? The answer is no, there is no limit. But here's what you need to do, be smart. Let's try to limit civilian casualties the best we can. Let's put humanitarian aid in areas that protect the innocent. I'm all for that. But this idea that Israel has to apologize for attacking Hamas, who's embedded with their own population, needs to stop. The goal is to destroy Hamas. Hamas is creating these casualties, not Israel.
You mention the consequences of the colonial struggle in the African continent in particular. And I think it's quite an astute observation given everything that's been happening over the last couple of months in Central Africa, in the sub-Saharan belt, specifically with the coups in a number of countries, and the reaction from that we're seeing from the French government specifically, that is trying to maintain a sense of control over what's happening there. You are somebody that spent the early part of your career studying Africa and also working there as a journalist. What did you see and observe about the consequences of Western colonialism in that part of the world that applies to what we're seeing today, not only in Palestine, but across the region?
You see, there is a habit, in my opinion, very bad habit in the Western mind, in particular the American mind, of ignoring or not understanding how nations think about themselves outside the Western realm, the Western world. Take, for example, the Africans. The Africans have been going through centuries of humiliation and slavery and colonialism. Still, they are suffering from the consequences of that. You see what's happening in West Africa and in many other parts of Africa. And the West couldn't understand that their responsibility towards Africa, for example, should go beyond just certain kind of lip service, which is to a large extent actually Hippocratic. And they ignored Africa, and they still look at it as a place where they can suck its wealth and marginalize it totally on the international scale. Now, Africa is changing. So the Africa that they dealt with decades ago is much more educated, much more connected, much more capable of looking at itself as a continent that could produce much better than what the European framework or the American framework would like to have for it. And they have options. They have China, they have Russia, they have many other options. This is why the Western mind is stuck in the past. They cannot see that the world has changed. There are now the world order that the West built after the Second World War and the American-centric approach to international reality is actually shifting, and shifting very fast. But it is not noticed or seen properly by decision makers. This is why they still deal with the world with their imperial lenses. And this is why not only Africa, but also look at Asia. Look at China itself. China went through a century of humiliation from during the Opium Wars up to 1949, 100 years of humiliation. And the Chinese, in the Chinese historical terminology, they call it the century of humiliation. Africa went through more than three centuries of humiliation. The Arab world went through at least a century of humiliation as well, or more than that. After the 1917, all of our countries basically were under colonial rule directly. And therefore, this kind of humiliation has built a collective memory. And this memory did not die away, because I think our nations are very faithful to its legacy, civilization, and collectiveness. It's not individualistic in nature, like the Western philosophical liberalism, when individualism is at the center of its thinking. So people do actually accumulate this kind of memory, generation after another generation. And when there is in front of them an opportunity to express or to move on beyond the doctrine the West wanted them to be stuck in, they will do it. And I think right now, since the world order the Americans have built is actually collapsing, and there is a new world order that has not been formed, and there are cracks everywhere in the international wall of American sovereignty, in my opinion, the global South is ready to make the move from Latin America to Africa to Asia and to many parts of the world, to move beyond the American and Western hegemonic philosophy, culture, and ethical, self-righteousness. And I think, yeah, they cannot see it, but I can see it. It's happening. It will take years, might be decades, but definitely the West is losing, losing very quick and very fast, unless some kind of new spirit emerges, representing the true values that the West was one day faithful for. 3 centuries ago, when the ideals of liberalism emerged, before they were militarized and used as a tool of oppression and subjugation in all parts of the world, when we go back to the ideals that the early philosophers of Enlightenment introduced to us, yes, we will respect that. But unfortunately, it has been sacrificed for the sake of accumulating wealth, centralizing power, and dominating the world while destroying civilizations, cultures, and respect for humans everywhere in this planet.
The conventional wisdom that you've seen in American thinking specifically over the last couple of administrations is that the best way to deal with the Middle East and the Arab world is to deal with the Israel-Palestine issue. And that this was an issue that is central to the thinking of the region and the way that Arab hearts are aligned, and that without it, without any kind of resolution, it would be difficult to be able to resolve the relationship between the West and the Middle East. Over the last few years, that thinking has shifted. And you saw the attempts at normalization with the Arab world and the deals that were struck between Netanyahu's administration and the UAE, Bahrain, the Sudan, and Morocco, and this outward conversation now that Israel was moving to almost a post-Palestine reality, and that you have Arab partners in that reality. And then what you saw on the last couple of weeks is the reversal of that. You have the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on a rapid, almost frantic tour of the Middle East, trying to speak and calm down sentiments and reactions in the region. You have the U.S. moving its military into the Mediterranean, into the region, to try and calm down or prevent any kind of regional escalation. Is that kind of an admission that the last 3 years of thinking that you could move past the Palestinian issue were wrong and now are kind of falling apart?
Yes, of course. I mean, this is very clear now to everyone, because you see, the Americans, maybe 3 years ago, they decided that they would like to reduce their engagement in various parts of the world to dedicate more resources to China. And that was publicly, you know, the strategy. And maybe they thought that by handing over the Middle East to regional powers, including the Israelis and the Saudis, and encouraging the normalization between both of them, they will dedicate more resources outside the region to Southeast Asia and so on. Of course, that was the plan. That plan did not include the Palestinian issue, in essence. It had, as I said, certain kind of terminology about the Palestinian issue to resume the so-called peace process, which is laughable because, I mean, every Palestinian knows that the peace process is just a sham. It's something used normally, just lip service for nothing, to achieve nothing. So the idea was, let us put this region under control of the American allies while we dedicate our resources to the rest of the world, especially to China and Russia. And that did not include the Palestinians. That narrative collapsed on the 7th of October, for many reasons. One of them, that the Palestinians proved again that they are at the center of the security of the Middle East. You cannot ignore the Palestinians. As I said, you cannot just ignore them and putting them in concentration camps and have an apartheid state in Israel that the world will be at peace with it and the region will accept. So this is not at all possible. And that's most important for the region as well and for the world, that when the Arab Spring happened, a lot of literature in think tanks in the West started to assume that the Arab world has forsaken the Palestinian issue, and people now are busy thinking about their immediate domestic issues. But on the 7th of October and aftermath, we see that the demonstrations in the Arab world, the emotions across the global South, is denying actually this kind of assumption and introducing the original fact that the Palestinian issue is central to the Arabs and Muslims and the global South, and even to a lot of people in the West who are also seeing the truth and are angry with their governments. So, yes, the Palestinian issue is back to the center. And there is no talk now about normalization. And if anyone dares at this stage to speak about normalization, definitely he will be faced with a lot of angry response from the region, from the people, I mean. So this is important. The second important issue as well, look at the world has changed. I mean, during the last few years, of course, we had the Ukrainian war, which also came before 7th of October. The Ukrainian war also established some form of imbalance regarding the Western dominance, because a lot of global South did not take the American narrative and did not participate in the way in blockading Russia and so on and so forth, sanctions against Russia. And therefore, what happened on 7th of October is a continuity of that kind of approach. And this is why the frustration from the Western dominance, in my opinion, is now becoming deeply rooted, is not just a phenomena out of the 7th of October. It has been built up during the last few years, but it has reached a moment of maturity right now. And therefore, from now on, I think the countries in the global South will start thinking of alliances much more stronger and much more closer to each other than they thought before. We have seen how BRICS, for example, wanted to expand and to consolidate. But now I think more and more countries, supported by nations on the ground, by people, I mean, will start thinking of how to break away from this American fanatic mindset and try to establish something much more reasonable and much more open-minded to the change in the international world order. This is why the future is going to be very different from what we have seen. And what I saw in the 7th of October historically as a moment where the world is actually encouraging itself to go beyond the hegemonic power of the Americans and the American-centered alliance. Mm.
In the weeks that preceded, I mean days really, before October 7th, when so much speculation was happening with regards to the normalization talks between Saudi Arabia and Israel that were being brokered by the Biden administration, one of the things that the Saudis were attempting to gain from the U.S. is a so-called security guarantee, this idea that they wanted a partnership or almost a promise from the U.S. that it would protect Saudi Arabia from any future threats, namely a threat from their neighbors in Iran. And the U.S. was incredibly reluctant to put anything on the table with regards to doing that. And you know, the analysis seemed to suggest that the U.S. did not want to bog itself down in the region and create a situation for itself that necessitated a military response that it wasn't ready to do.
Yeah.
What we're seeing happening now is the exact same thing, but with Israel.
Yeah, so the Israelis would have not been happy to give the Saudis what they asked for. I mean, I will refer you again to the tweet that Netanyahu had on the in December 2022. It's very 28th of December 2022. He spoke about, of course, his government program, and he said, "These are the basic lines of the national government headed by me. The Jewish people have an exclusive and unquestionable right to all areas of the land of Israel. The government will promote and develop settlements in all parts of the land of Israel. Of course, the land of Israel, capital letter, is in the, he says, the Galilee, the Negev, the Golan, Judea, and Samaria, which means basically the West Bank and Golan Heights. So therefore, there's nothing called Palestinian land. The second one, he said the government will work actively to fortify national security and to provide personal security to its citizens while fighting violence and terrorism with determination. For third, the government will work to fight against Iran's nuclear program. This is another confrontation in the region. And that the government will work to strengthen the status of Jerusalem, which means another war against the Muslim world again. And then the government will work to promote peace with all our neighbors while preserving Israel's security and historical interest. So the point, Israel's security while normalizing with neighbors. I will preserve Israel's security, which means I'm not going to strengthen their security. Second, I am going to have peace with them while I am taking over the mosque, Al-Masjid Al-Aqsa, which means also I'm putting them in confrontation with their people, and that would delegitimize a regime that will accept a deal that Jerusalem has been sacrificed for it. Third, I am going to normalize with some while fighting against others. I will normalize with neighbors, but I will also fight against Iran and its program, nuclear program. And I'm going to put security of Israel above everything else. So basically, what kind of model you are introducing to the region is a model of polarization and a model of confrontation that if it has not even happened on the 7th of October, it would have happened any other moment. Because basically, you are putting the seeds of conflict in the region rather than having a region that is in a way or another open to some form of alliances that could come together. But you are actually dividing the region by talking about normalization with someone and fighting with someone else. And in my opinion, that would have, even on its own, without 7th of October, led to some form of confrontation in the region, and no peace will come out of such an imagination.
Joe Biden has, for a very long time throughout his career, spoken very highly of his support of military partnership with Israel, and spoke multiple times throughout the 80s and 90s of Israel as being a security asset of the U.S. There's a quote of his that says, you know, if Israel didn't exist, then we would have to create one, and that the absence of Israel would necessitate an even larger U.S. military presence in the region. What we are seeing today, has Israel become a military liability for the U.S.?
And a moral liability. Liability. So, yes, it reminds me of South Africa, actually. South Africa was, in a way or another, the country in the continent that was the ally of the Western powers against the Soviet and the communist world. But in 1989, when the Eastern Bloc started to collapse, and the Soviet Union has started to lose its status as a major power against the Americans, also South Africa started losing its status, because it has been very high liability morally, and also the pressure against the Western powers to rethink apartheid regime in South Africa start to grow in the West, in the capitals of the West, as we see regarding Israel as well. So the shift happened, and the white regime in South Africa had to negotiate with the Africans and to reach the agreement of sharing power that Nelson Mandela after that implemented when he became a president, 1994. So the issue is, such regimes that are based on colonial settler mentality, that are becoming apartheid entities, they cannot actually survive outside some form of international sphere of interest. When that international sphere of interest starts to shift, their status has to shift as well, because they might not serve exactly the same strategic purpose that they served. So Israel did not want to become part of the region by normalizing truly with people. So they were trying to normalize with regimes, with some regimes, fight with another regime, and at the same time denying people their right of existence, the Palestinians, I mean, and denying the larger population of the Arab world their right to have the mosque of Al-Aqsa, for example, or the issue of Palestine, which is very close to the hearts of people, resolved properly and sincerely. So they have been building on that old hegemonic regime supported by the centers of power in the West. Now, when the world is shifting towards something new, the status of Israel will start to shift as well. And slowly, it becomes a liability militarily and a liability morally. And we can't see it right now because, as I said, the imbalance in the Western leadership, while the Western hegemonic power is actually diminishing. So there is a panic and there is lack of strategic thinking and there is decline of wisdom in most of the minds of the Western leaders. And therefore, they are now taking very strong action, which in my opinion, versus against their international interest and their regional interest in our part of the world. So yes, this is very complicated, but on long run, yes, Israel is a great liability to the West.
I want to round up our conversation by staying with South Africa, where you spent a lot of time reporting on in the years after the collapse of the apartheid regime. There is often this comparison, this parallel drawn between Israel and apartheid South Africa because of the system of apartheid, because of a system of settler colonialism, because of the racial divisions that exist. But do you think where things are right now, which feel very heightened, feel very far from any kind of resolution, do you think Israel is destined to go the way of South Africa?
You see, the point is the following. South Africa itself consisted of colonial settler entity based on racist supremacy and supported by the Western powers. So that definitely is similar to what's happening right now in Israel. And later on, that changed, and therefore the status of South Africa started to decline, and the world, you know, in a way or another, gave up on South Africa. So on Israel, it will take longer, because there is something connecting the Israelis to the Western racist mentality, actually, the Western centers of power more than the people. When I say the West, I don't mean the people, actually. I mean the centers of power in the West. And that connection is deep. It goes beyond the calculations of geopolitics only. And I think it has been the issue of Zionism, which is an Occidental issue, not Oriental issue. I mean, it has been in Europe for decades, anti-Semitism and Zionism. And therefore, the issue of Palestine has deep roots in the Western thinking, not because of love to Zionism or love to the Jewish population, but it is basically something that comes from the dark history that Western nations actually dealt with the Jews in the West, because the only region in the world that opened up for Jews to settle and to live as respected citizens was the Oriental region, it means the Middle East, the Islamic countries, the Ottoman Empire, Baghdad, Cairo, Morocco. So we had Jews living naturally when they were evacuated from Spain. They actually sought refuge in the Muslim land, and they were respected, and they lived peacefully, and we had no issue. We do not have in our culture anything called anti-Semitism. We don't have equivalent to that. This is a phenomenon born in the West. So when the West now is supporting Israel, I don't think they are supporting it because of this kind of geopolitical calculations only, but also that kind of of guilt factor involved in history. And unfortunately, they made the Palestinians pay the price instead of them trying to create certain kind of balance in that land. And of course, this is again endangering the whole international order. As I said, this event will trigger some form of proxy regional confrontation that might go beyond this. So to answer your question, I am hesitant to say that the calculations are geopolitical only, and I think we need to sit down and to think of a new imagination about what should be done in the land, and we need to trigger the historical precedents, which I refer to, because our region was the most tolerant region to the Jewish settlement when the Jewish settlements during the last few centuries was natural, integrated, and it was actually part of the mosaic, cultural, religious, sectarian mosaic of the Middle East. And Muslims, Christians, and Jews lived together without any kind of enmity or hostility. We did not have the same experience that the West had with the Jews. So that is a model, in my opinion, is deep down in our memory and history in the region, in the Middle East. Which, in my opinion, if the Israelis think strategically, they need to become part of this region and to stop trying to think outside as just colonial settlers who have come there in order to besiege themselves with walls, because that cannot continue. That will happen one day, that it will be destroyed. That kind of model cannot survive. This apartheid regime cannot survive. This kind of system cannot survive. This is based on something that humanity eventually will reject. You know, so new imagination, new thinking should emerge. And that thinking had precedence in history. It's not something that is unique. So if we go back to that precedence, we can start imagining something beyond the current polarization and conflict.
And how do we get to that precedent, back to that idea that you described of what the region once was? How do we get back there?
So let me be frank with you. This Middle East, which we deal with today, is a legacy of colonialism, basically. You know, we have been divided into certain kind of entities and Sykes-Picot and after the First World War. And that put the seeds of conflict in the region itself. And Israel was planted as well in the region through the British mandate over Palestine. And all that was done without consulting the people. So it does not have legitimacy. This whole structure is not legitimate based on what we think about ourselves in the region, what people think about themselves. It is not a natural progress that this region has reached to. And this is why for 100 years, we couldn't establish legitimate political entities that have deep legitimacy in the minds of people and the hearts of people, unfortunately. This is why we have failure of Arab state now. Most of the Arab states are failing, not capable of delivering, basic services to their people. Security-wise, we are suffering from all kinds of confrontations and wars. So a new thinking about the region should not abide by one particular set of rules that were inserted 100 years ago. Now, you might argue that nation states in the region has become a reality. I might agree that states in the region, although the word nation states I don't accept too much regarding the Middle East, because I don't think we have that kind of concept based on the official description of what nation state is. But let us assume, yes, states are there. But who can prevent us from start thinking beyond the state? The Europeans fought against each other. In 30 years, they killed about 100 million between the First and the Second World War. But eventually, they started immediately after the Second World War thinking about a European Union, where Germany, which was basically, you know, the enemy, start to integrate and the economy start to flourish. I'm not saying that Israel could become. Israel of today cannot become part of that because unfortunately Israel is not thinking of itself as part of that situation. It might start to think if they acknowledge the right of the Palestinians and they actually sincerely start giving back the Palestinians the right to claim their land, the refugees to go back to their land, the justice to be served, and the occupation and its impact to be dissolved, then we can talk about certain kind of reality where people, based on justice, equality, can live. But now, given the circumstances, even if we think about larger Middle East, where economy, because the economic solution was presented by Shimon Peres and others, but it can never be done without resolving the Palestinian issue. You know, so if we think about the Middle East in the future to be the land of peace and prosperity, while Israel is doing what they are doing right now, and while Israel is preserving its supremacy and its divine right of denying everyone else's existence, I think we cannot have a stable Middle East and will continue to have this kind of chaotic situation that we are in.
We began this conversation on a very catastrophic place and vision of what's happening right now. And I feel like we've ended it on a place that looks like a somewhat of a clearing in the clouds. And thank you for shedding light on what could come next and what we should hope for in the future. Well, Wadaa Khanfur, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So much.
The Big Picture is produced and presented by me, Mohammed Hassan, for Middle East Eye. Recording and filming is by Hassan Sarhan, with graphics from Enes Ale. You can watch all of our episodes in video format on YouTube and get up close and personal. If you like our conversations, please consider following the show and giving us a rating. It goes a very long way. Also, tell your friends. And until next time, salam.